Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows.
Welcome to the Lifeboat Hour, August 24, 2014, and I'm your host, Carolyn Baker. Everybody knows, if they didn't already know, that the United States has become a police state. And everybody also knows that some parts of the United States are no less racist than they were 400 years ago. Of course, I'm talking about the events that have transpired in Ferguson, Missouri since August 9, and that even 47 years after the long, hot summer of 1967, police brutality and racial profiling are still alive and well in this country. And tonight on this show, we'll be discussing not so much the events of Ferguson, but another situation fueled by racism and brutality in the United States foreign policy as a result of the United States foreign policy 3 decades ago, which is showing up as blowback on our doorstep in the form of the child migrant crisis on the U.S. southern border. Now, before I introduce our guest, and we're actually waiting for our guest because she's going to be calling in, or hopefully calling in, from Mexico, so we have some technical issues with this. But as we're waiting for that, I want to let you know that next week my guest will be Adam Bucco, co-author of Occupy Spirituality, A Radical Vision for a New Generation. Adam works with homeless youth in New York City and also works closely with Andrew Harvey, who was my guest on this show 2 weeks ago. Similar to the show that I did on August 3rd with Tyler Hess, next week's show will be a dialogue between generations regarding the work of intergenerational sacred activists, and you won't want to miss it. So, still waiting for our guest, and in the background, I need to let her know that she needs to call in to Progressive Radio Network. We're waiting for her momentarily. And we'll get to her as soon as we can. Our guest is Laura Carlson, and I'm going to tell you about her in a moment. But to give you some background, I was personally shaken to my core a couple of months ago. Well, I guess it was actually back in May, when Al Jazeera America TV ran a fabulous documentary series called Borderlands, in which 6 Americans made the exact journey from Central America to the United States that most migrants make on that trek. And the way this was structured is that these 6 Americans started out in the Pima County morgue in Tucson, where they viewed dozens, if not hundreds, of bodies of migrants which were found in the Arizona desert and remained unidentified. Each of the 6 were assigned the name and photo of one of the deceased. From there, they went to Honduras and lived with the very poor families of the deceased in Honduras, picking coffee beans for practically nothing and living for a few days in the conditions of the locals. From there, they boarded the infamous migrant train called La Bestia, or the Beast, which takes perhaps 500 migrants a day, riding on top of freight cars on a very dangerous journey through Mexico toward the U.S. border. And after arriving in northern Mexico, they hiked through the Sonoran Desert in Mexico to the U.S. and experienced firsthand how treacherous and physically brutal the journey to the border is. Unlike the hundreds of thousands of migrants who've made the same journey or who have died trying to make it, they were picked up on the U.S. side by the Pima County Coroner's Office and taken back to Tucson to debrief. Three of the six Americans were very accepting of migrants coming to the U.S., and three were not. Of the three who were not, two of them were totally transformed by the experience. They literally became different human beings as a result of it. You can watch large segments of this documentary by going to Al Jazeera America, to the website, or you may be able to catch it on the Al Jazeera America TV channel. Now, someone who knows this journey well is our guest, Laura Carlson. She knows the journey well not because she's made it, but she's met many, many people who have made it, and she's also intimately familiar with the statistics of thousands who've perished in the process. So we're waiting for her to call in momentarily. I think this is going to be a very good show for us tonight, and kind of take us on a different trek and a different subject matter than we have been doing. One of the things that pieces of feedback that I got today from folks was that people are really enjoying the variety of topics that we're doing on the Lifeboat Hour. So I'm hoping that we get our guest tonight and that we'll be able to listen to her, because she has some really, really amazing things to tell us. So, Laura Carlson works with, well, first of all, she's a political writer and analyst and a television and radio commentator. It looks like Laura is with us. Go ahead, Laura, and just let me know that you're there.
Yes, hello.
Hi, Laura. I'm just in the process of introducing you, okay?
Sure.
So bear with us. I was just saying that you're a political writer and analyst and a television and radio commentator. You are the director of the Americas program for the Center for International Policy and a pioneer in using internet publication to expand a North-South dialogue in the hemisphere in three languages. You're a dual citizen of Mexico and the United States, and you're a regular columnist for Huffington Post, Foreign Policy in Focus, and the Americas Updater Boletín Americas. You're also a regular TV commentator for Americas Now and Al Jazeera, and you host the internet TV show Interview in Mexico. You've appeared on Democracy Now!, Telesur, Univision, and NBC. Your journalistic work has won two Project Censored Awards. You've also written for The Nation, The New Internationalist, numerous academic journals, indie media, and you've been quoted in The Washington Post, The Christian Science Monitor, and scores of other newspapers and magazines on issues pertaining to U.S. foreign policy in the Western Hemisphere and Latin American affairs. And in the ongoing effort to build knowledge and relations between nations of the Americas, you've spoken on the drug war, U.S. policy, and Latin American grassroots movements at more than 50 U.S. universities and organizations throughout Latin America. Laura Carlson, welcome to the Lifeboat Hour. Are you there, Laura?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Welcome to the show. Did you hear my introduction?
Yes, I can hear you fine.
Okay, great. So at the moment, we have tens of thousands of child migrants from Central American countries sitting on the U.S. southern border awaiting processing as undocumented immigrants. Some estimates are that by the end of this year, there will be 90,000 or more of these kids in this situation. As we know, each undocumented migrant has the right to a court hearing before a judge to have his or her case heard and be able to request permission to remain in the U.S. So before I ask you any other questions, I want to know what numbers you currently have for kids essentially stranded on the U.S. border.
Well, the numbers began when this first became news in at 52,000, and the number that the only place we can get a registration is now up to 57,000, and that's probably not the most updated figure. Children are still coming. There are reports that the flow has decreased in intensity since this came out, and some of the efforts to discourage people went into place. But the deportations have also increased.
And so can you give us that number again? Because you kind of got garbled when you said the current number. Can you say that again?
57,000.
How many?
57,000.
57,000. So in the U.S., we have voices on the political right who are screaming very loudly and hatefully about these migrant children being here. And a few weeks ago, we had the crazed psycho blogger and radio personality Michael Savage asserting that these kids have horrible diseases and infections and were essentially sent here intentionally to contaminate Americans and spread disease. A number of TV networks in the U.S. have shown us footage in recent weeks of hateful mobs in various cities protesting the arrival of some of these migrant children and sometimes their mothers. Most notable was the protest in Murrieta, California a few weeks back. And when I see this, my jaw drops as a result of the blatant ignorance of these folks regarding what's caused this unprecedented surge in migrants from Central America on the border. So one reason I wanted to have you on the show tonight was to first dispel the insane rumors about these human beings being carriers of disease who've been sent here to contaminate Americans, and secondly, to give us the historical and geopolitical background of this crisis. So I'll begin by asking you the following. What are the current conditions in each country from which these migrants originate that are forcing them to come here?
Okay, well, to back up just a little bit and address some of the things you said, you can add to that list. I know we've had reports here, and I don't know if they're accurate enough, about Ku Klux Klan activity related to this a real nativist reaction to the news that children were, that there was a surge in child migrants to the United States. So the hate response has been very, very high in certain segments of the United States, and that's been something that, of course, countries south of the border have viewed with both alarm and a certain incomprehension, you know, at how people could respond in this way to children who are coming out of desperation, making a very dangerous journey to the United States. So that desperation is really what's behind this.
Right.
And that's something that the United States has not recognized in to the degree that it's necessary in order to understand the situation at all. The desperation comes from both the current situation in each one of these countries, which is slightly different. We're talking about four countries primarily: Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. In this current crisis, we don't hear very much about Mexico because although it does represent about a quarter of the child migrants that are in this situation, that's remained stable, at least since NAFTA, when the North American Free Trade Agreement, when migration shot up because of displacement, and since the drug war, when violence caused further displacement within Mexico. So the surge we're seeing is not from Mexico, and that's why we're hearing much more about what's happening in Central America. It's these three Central American countries that really represent the increase in numbers that's happened over, it's somewhat arguable, but it's really been happening over about 2 years. And the Border Patrol identifies kind of a spike in about October of last year. And so do some of the migrant shelters here in Mexico. But it's been steady for about 2 years. So what's happening in these three countries? Extreme poverty is a constant in all three of these countries and has actually worsened in at least in most of them in terms of the absolute numbers of people who are living in extreme poverty. Here, it's interesting to mention that Nicaragua also has the same level of extreme poverty, and yet it doesn't have the same level of out-migration. And there you see the difference that some public policies can make in terms of being able to keep people at home and offer them at least some hope of addressing the poverty issues. And
will
also Nicaragua. Yes?
Will you be saying more about the policies in Nicaragua that you're talking about right now?
The biggest thing is that they don't have the same problem with violence as the other three countries have, because if they haven't moved to this militarized security model that's been enforced in the other three countries as a result of the drug war that's been promoted by the United States. They also have some more participatory processes in Nicaragua that actually have been bringing down some of the poverty levels in some regions. And the other thing that we have to take into account is Nicaraguans are migrating, but they're migrating to Costa Rica. So that's one of the things that's happening in that country too. So we're not seeing Nicaragua as being one of the major contributors to this surge in child migrants. In Guatemala, of the people that I've talked to, the violence is one of the main reasons, especially among the children and the mothers who are bringing their children out of those countries, that has fueled this spike in the migration rate from these countries. And this is especially true of Honduras, which now has the highest homicide rate in the world. So let's look a little bit at the history of Honduras and how it got to this crisis situation. And it's pretty easy to track, unfortunately. There were a series of very, very major mistakes that continue to be made to this day and that continue to be the product of ideological policies that are being stubbornly pursued by both the Honduran and the United States government, despite the fact that they've had this tragic impact on the society itself and have been a major factor in basically pushing people out of the country to save their lives. In Honduras, after the coup in June of 2009, Honduras became a country divided, where there was massive protest and massive repression by a military coup government. The United States played a major role in engineering elections without a return to the democratically elected and constitutional government beforehand. That is to say, elections in November of 2009 that were actually run by an illegal military coup. So a huge part of the country didn't recognize those elections. And then the elections that just took place recently again divided the country. And what we've seen is a steady erosion in the rule of law within Honduras that has led to the violence and the infiltration of very dangerous and brutal criminal gangs, as well as many of the people that we talk to that are refugees from Honduras mentioned that they are in as much danger oftentimes from the security forces themselves, the police and the military, as they are from the drug gangs, because corruption and abuses are so rampant among the security forces themselves that they themselves pose a threat to the society. So Honduras has gone from being a basket case to being a virtual hell for many of its own residents. One of the most common things that we've heard in talking to Honduran refugees is that I'll ask them, I'll say, so why did you leave your country? As kind of the standard first question. And they'll look at me kind of strangely and they'll say, everyone in Honduras would leave if they could.
Right.
And of course, there's an oligarchy. There's a handful of very wealthy people who are just fine with the situation as it is. But to a large degree, that statement reflects the generalized despair of people living in Honduras today.
Okay. Thank you for that. We're gonna just kind of pause right there for a song. And then I want to hear a lot more from you, Laura. But I'd like to play a song right now. And you know, well, the reason that we play songs on this show is to kind of set a mood or a tone. And the one we have for tonight is a song that grabbed my heart as I was preparing for this show. It's played by the fabulous Argentinian composer and artist Gustavo Santaolalla, whose music is featured in a number of Hollywood movies. And this particular song captures the mood that we're setting here tonight on the Lifeboat Hour. The purpose of playing it is to allow it to move us. And so let this one move you. This is Pampa by Gustavo Santaolalla. Thank you. Welcome back to the Lifeboat Hour. I'm Carolyn Baker, and tonight we're talking with Laura Carlson, who is the director of the Americas Program for the Center for International Policy. And Laura, I'm wondering if you'll talk about the weak institutions in these Central American countries, the rule of law, and the militarization and authoritarianism of law enforcement in these countries.
Yeah. We just got through Honduras in before the break, and so I wanted to talk a little about the other countries and bring in that issue, because that's absolutely critical to what's happening as well. When we talk to people from Guatemala, the situation is a little bit different from Honduras. Of course, there wasn't a recent coup in Guatemala. There was a U.S.-backed coup in 1954 that led to internal conflict and a civil war that went on until 1996 and really destroyed the fabric of society during that time, with the well-known now genocidal campaigns that took place as well, and the United States' response being, if not openly supportive, at least permissive, as these things were going on. The situation in Guatemala now, generally speaking, the people that I've spoken to and from the interviews that I've seen, you find more people in Guatemala citing extreme poverty. And this comes not only because they've never been able to kind of get on track in terms of including excluded sectors, particularly indigenous peoples and rural sectors, into a development model, but also because with the recent wave of globalization and the Central American Free Trade Agreement, the mega projects and this export-oriented, foreign investment-oriented model is excluding these people even more. So you're finding people that have no way to make a living anymore because they've been forced off their land by hydroelectric projects, by mining projects, by mostly extractive and tourism projects, and major foreign investment type projects that are displacing indigenous people and the people who have lived in those communities for centuries. So they've reached a point where it's there's no way to continue to survive in their own homes, many of the people in Guatemala. And then in El Salvador, you have the gang problem, where, again, it's violence, and it's the infiltration of gangs and their power. And, again, you just can't help but make the relationship to U.S. policies and U.S. involvement in the region, because many of these gangs were formed and indoctrinated in the first wave of immigration. The immigration wave that we're seeing right now from El Salvador is really the second wave, because the United States received so many people during the dirty wars and the death squad activities in the 80s. These people's children now are being deported back to El Salvador, where they're where they're getting involved in gangs because, in large part, of the lack of other options for youth. And that's what's happening now. Now, the point that you mentioned that's very interesting is the point of the weak institutions, and especially the judicial and penal systems in all of these countries that have made it impossible for the countries, even if they were doing a better effort, to try to control the violence that's so many parts. These institutions have been eroded by these illegal activities, including the coup in Honduras, a return to military control in large parts of Guatemala, because what we're seeing under the drug war policy of the United States is a remilitarization. And that means that the police forces, the security positions, now are run in 40% of the cases by former military officials, and they've deployed some 21,000 troops to maintain security throughout the country. Well, these are military officials that have, in many cases, been linked to the historic crimes of the past, and who are also functioning with a logic of repression and annihilation, as a foreign military does, which is very different from what public safety officials such as police should be doing. So they're becoming as well a threat to their own people. in Guatemala and other places. This is the complexity of the situation we see. In general, we're talking about institutions where in all three countries, approximately 95% of crimes committed are never investigated, prosecuted, sentenced, and punished. They don't make it through the justice system at all. And they're diverted by inefficiency. They're diverted by a high degree of corruption, where the investigations don't take place. If organized crime is involved, it's quite easy for them to buy off officials. And this means that we really are talking about a climate of impunity, in which there's no recourse for people who are subject to abuses.
Okay, I want to talk a little bit about the country of Mexico, and we're going to forego a station break tonight because the connection with you is tentative, so I don't want to do anything to mess that up. We just want to stay on target here with what you're saying. As you have said, and as the Al Jazeera Borderlands documentary showed, Mexico has a very important role in this crisis. Would you explain that role to us, please?
Yeah, well, Mexico is the country of transit in this case, when we're talking about the Central American migrants. And what Central American migrants go through on their trip through Mexico has become a huge international scandal, really. The conditions of including from safety and all types of dangers along the route, once they pass through into Mexico and on their way to the United States, are basically out of control. What happens is that the migrants are forced, because to avoid apprehension within Mexico, they're forced to ride on transportation like La Bestia. And La Bestia is the beast. It's the name of the freight train that migrants ride from the southern border up through Mexico. And this has become the territory of organized criminal groups who use the train to extort migrants, and not just the train. They're captured as they walk along the roads, almost any mode of transportation. The organized crime groups will kidnap the migrants. They're sometimes forcibly recruited into carrying drugs, small drug shipments into the United States. They're kidnapped and forced to contact their relatives in the United States in order to pay $2,000-$3,000 for their lives. And in many, many cases, when they do not cooperate or they can't pay what the criminal groups are asking of them, they're massacred. We have the massacre of San Fernando in 2010 in the northern border in Tamaulipas, where 72 bodies of migrants were found, mostly Central Americans. When you add in the dangers to children, it's clear that they face everything from exposure to the elements to also being subject to the kidnappings and the terrorism that comes not just from organized criminal groups, but also from Mexican migration authorities and police as well. Again, when you ask the migrants, they will say that the security officers of the country are as much a threat to them as the criminals are. There's cases of rape. Rape is very common. It's estimated between 60 and 80% of women who travel through Mexico are subject to sexual abuse. Many of them begin birth control before leaving their homes in Central America, knowing that this is something that they will have to face along the way.
So many of them get contraceptive shots. Is that not true, because they are just wanting to be prepared for this?
Yeah, they go to the pharmacies, the reports that we have, and they ask for the Mexican pill. And that's birth control pills that that they associate with Mexico, because they take them to avoid getting pregnant following a rape.
In addition to rape, are there other issues about women migrating here with their children that you'd like us to know about?
Well, yeah, I think that the women migrating is one of the most invisible parts of this whole crisis. You know, it's been very strange how this suddenly came into the news cycle in the United States, and there's quite a bit of evidence that shows that it was planned to have precisely the reaction that it has had, that it originated with Breitbart News from some photos that were supposedly leaked by the border control and by the border patrol directly to this right-wing news service. And this created a huge scandal. And although the original reaction and President Obama's famous phrase was that we're facing a humanitarian crisis, shortly thereafter and almost simultaneously, we saw this anti-immigration backlash. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't coincidental that this backlash came right at a time when there was a significant reason to believe that the executive branch was going to come out with some executive orders to slow deportations and begin to try to fix immigration policy, given the lack of movement in the legislature. In the legislative branch. So we whipped up, you know, we saw that this whole anti-immigrant backlash and the kinds of the hate crimes and the hate language that you discussed at the beginning of the show began to spread across the country. And it was ironically sparked by the plight of children, you know, by something that should stir compassion in every heart, and yet in many, it's precisely the opposite. The opposite. The opposite. So that's been, you know, a huge problem. And for women, since unaccompanied minors in the United States, as you mentioned, are registered because of the Victims Protection Act that involves the possibility of their being trafficked. They are given due process. They cannot be immediately deported without being interviewed and reviewed on the basis of a possible asylum case or any dangers they might face in terms of trafficking or being returned to their countries. So this is a special protection that's very necessary for these kids. And ordinarily, they go through this process, and in the meantime, they stay with relatives, because we also have to keep in mind that many of these children are not being sent up to the United States by their parents, which is something that's been said frequently in the news media in the United States. They're being called for by their parents. Mm-hmm. The policies that we have towards Central America have already broken up their families. Mm-hmm. And they're looking for safety by trying to be with their mother and father, who should provide them a family, and who are desperately trying to do that by having their children sent up. And they're not unaccompanied. They're generally speaking traveling with a coyote, which is a human trafficker, which of course is no guarantee of safety whatsoever. But it's not just children coming completely by themselves. And then the reason that women have become invisible in all this is that since these children, the unaccompanied ones, are registered and have a special set of hearings that could facilitate their possible ability to remain in the country when they do face the kinds of dangers that they're facing, we have those numbers. But for women, and including women and children, they can be sent directly back. And for all Mexicans, which is another exception to this special protection that exists. So people, what they don't realize is that this is a crisis not only of unaccompanied children, but also of women and children. And that's due to what we call a chain of despair. That at some point in the family could no longer feed the children, and so the father migrated to the United States and began to work and send money back in the best mm-hmm. of cases. Right. At that point, you know, the mother's desperately trying with remittances and a job to sustain the children, and violence begins to grow in the community. And then you have older children, first boys, then girls, teenagers, going up north. And finally, when there's no other options left, and many mothers, what they say is, so here I am working three jobs to just put beans and rice on the table, and the gangs are coming by and threatening my son with death if he doesn't join. Mm-hmm. And she said, I didn't go through all this sacrifice to raise my children to become gang members, you know, and be shot in the streets. And that's when you find the mothers and children confronting all the dangers they have to confront and migrating up north to join the rest of their family as well. Yet those numbers are not well known. The mothers are not provided with the same kinds of protections that the unaccompanied minors are provided with. And as women, they face these specific risks of sexual violence and of exploitation in sex trafficking and kidnapping for sex trafficking along the route in Mexico.
And so, Laura, you know, a real linchpin here of all of this is the U.S. drug war, which has been going on for the last 30-some years and continues today. And so what is the role of the drug war in the current moment?
Well, it's absolutely critical to what's happening, and it has been a major contributing factor to the crisis that we're seeing right now. And that's because the drug war has imposed this military enforcement model on these countries. And it's that militarization coupled with the growth of organized crime, which ironically, and I'll talk about this, is a direct result of this drug war model that has that has caused a spike in violence. It's forcing people to leave, and it has caused a massive infiltration of organized crime within their communities. So they're facing both the violence from the security forces themselves that are funded and armed by the United States, and the violence from the criminal organizations that have become far more ruthless since the crackdown and the war on drugs began first in 2006 in Mexico and with the Merida Initiative, and later the Central American Regional Security Initiative from the United States to the Mexico and Central American region. Now, the reason that organized crime has grown and become so much more violent as a result of the drug war has to do, again, with this enforcement model. The drug war has a strategy of going after kingpins or drug lords who lead the cartels in an attempt to supposedly weaken and dismantle them. The only problem is that this is a strategy that has never worked anywhere in the world. You may manage to dismantle an organization like Pablo Escobar in Colombia as a result of that, but what happens is that there's a fragmentation, and those fragments, those splinter groups from some of these major cartels have become the most ruthless and the most violent and more powerful groups in the region, and they have penetrated far more into daily living, you know, extorting people who go to sell their goods in the market, charging a quota for almost every kind of economic activity in territories that they control. They have a different way of operating than when it was a little bit more centralized among the major drug cartels. Now, the United States and the Central American and Mexican governments know this. They know that this strategy causes violence. And they keep repeating that somehow this is going to be the darkness before the dawn. And yet they also have no prognosis whatsoever for a dawn within any of our countries. In Mexico, we've seen this, and it's been absolutely, you know, tremendously frustrating to see this kind of bloodshed and to see the governments continue with this policies. But we also know that there's very powerful forces behind that. And they include the defense industries, the intelligence industries, you know, the Black Hawks and the Blackwaters in the United States that are constantly lobbying Congress to continue the drug war. And they conclude political elites that find it convenient to have their countries militarized at a time when some of their policies are very, very unpopular.
Absolutely. And so one of the final questions I want to ask you is, what can our listeners do, if anything, to assist migrants or organizations that are assisting migrants?
Well, they should look around for local, you know, I'm here in Mexico, and I know that there are organizations that are trying to give legal representation to the migrant children, and those are very important. Right now, Congress is on a break, and that means that it's a time when many people have access to their congressional representatives and events in their home states, and it's a good time to make a couple of very critical points. Because the plans that have come up, instead of, as I said, a compassionate response to what can we do about children who are between not just a rock and a hard place, but they're between, but they're actually seeking survival. They're running for their lives in these cases. What can we do for these kinds, in this kind of situation? Instead of that, what we've seen is more security, more drug war response.
Right.
So we
right.
see this hideous bill, and it almost couldn't have been worse that it come out of the House, that fortunately won't go anywhere. But we're also seeing even the Obama plan included $300 million in the first version for the Honduran National Police.
Wow.
In Congress, a record number of congressional representatives signed a letter to say, we cannot be funding the Honduran National Police. They are operating in a vacuum of law. They're abusing the citizenry on a regular basis, and there is absolute impunity for their crimes. And yet it included $300 million for the Honduran police, the Guatemalan forces, and insecurity in general. And then there was additional sending the National Guard to the border to protect us against children who are under death threats. That's
right.
The kind of country we've become.
Right.
You know, it doesn't make any sense. So they need to, the congressional representatives need to hear this. They need to hear that that security money needs to be cut out, that we have to fund the border infrastructure that provides processing, due process, and care for these children when they come into the country. And that we have to start changing these policies immediately, because they're the driving force of the tragedy that we're seeing now. We're basically seeing the results of policies that the United States itself has been imposing in these countries. And unless there's a major fix to these policies, the migration flows and the desperation of these people is not going to end. So it's very important, and one of the specific messages within that is the 2008 Victims Protection Act. There's a lot of pressure, not just from Republicans, but from Democrats as well, to eliminate it. That cannot be eliminated.
Mm-hmm.
It's fair, it's due process, it's humanitarian, you know, it's part of the basic values of the United States that at least used to be so important. If it's eliminated, people will just be bounced back over the border, or they'll be sent back to their home countries. And we already have, at the last report, there were 5 to 10 deported children who had been murdered in Honduras. And we don't have good ways to report that. That's just in San Pedro Sula, which is the most violent city. So that's what they're being sent back to.
I just want to direct our listeners' attention to the Counterpunch website, because Counterpunch published a wonderful article by you July 25, 2027. It's called Blowback on the Border. It really goes into great detail with a number of things that you've said here tonight. And, you know, I noticed over the weekend, it kind of obscurely reported in the news that the Obama administration has actually stopped looking for places in the country, in the United States, to shelter these children. In just a couple of minutes, Laura, what do you know about that?
Well, essentially, they stopped using the military bases and some of these big centers because they're being sued for the conditions in some of those detention centers. Mm-hmm. The conditions are really bad. And what they used to do, and what's far more humane and actually much less costly, including, is find the family members, often the kids' parents themselves, find the family members and release the children to the custody of family members as their legal proceedings are carried out. And so, as I understand it, they'll be doing more of this. But there's another ugly thing that's going on as part of that too, and that is that the United States, through the Merida Initiative, is pressuring Mexico, and Mexico has responded with an extreme increase in the number of deportations of Central Americans directly from Mexico before they ever reach the U.S. border. Mm-hmm. And so when the government comes out and says, our policies of dissuasion are working, they're not exactly dissuasion in the Central American countries. Really, it's more likely that the statistical drop in those migrant children is that they're being sent back from Mexico. And again, it's the same situation. They're being sent back from dangerous places. I just want to mention that also our work on this issue, it can be found at the Americas Program website at www.cipamericas.org. And in addition to some of what I've been writing and seeing from here in Mexico, we have a reporter investigator in El Salvador who's looking at some of the push factors as well as what's happening to those children when they get back to El Salvador, and have been contacting people in other countries and working with our partner organizations like the Guatemalan Human Rights Commission and others, and Rights Action and others, to get a whole regional picture, since this is, a transnational regional problem, and the solutions are going to have to be regional as well.
Well, I really want to thank you for all that. And would you repeat the website again, please?
Yes, certainly. It's www.cipamericas, all together lowercase, .org. And there people can subscribe for free to the e-zines that we put out, and they'll find, fairly constant source of information on this issue as well as on the drug war and other issues within the hemisphere.
Yeah, as CIP, as in Center for International Policy, it's really a treasure trove of information. And Laura Carlson, I want to thank you so much for being with us tonight and for giving us this amazing, amazing big picture of what is going on with the child migrant crisis, which takes us into larger and larger vistas of the situation. I so appreciate your work. Thank you for being on the show. Que le vaya bien. And we'll have you back again sometime. Take care. And everybody, we'll see you again next week, Lifeboat Hour listeners, with Adam Bucko. Have a good week.
The deal is rotten. Old Black Joe's still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows the boat is leaking. Everybody knows the captain lied. Everybody got this broken feeling like their father or their dog just died. Everybody talking to their pockets. Everybody wants a box of chocolates and a long stem rose. Everybody knows. Everybody knows that you love me, baby. Everybody knows you really do. Everybody knows you've been faithful, give or take a night or two. Everybody knows you've been discreet, but there were so many people you just had to meet without your clothes. Everybody knows.